Hello, and welcome to Addicted to Murder. This is Courtney, licensed professional counselor with over a decade of experience.
And this is Trisha, and the Casanova killer, a.k.a. Paul John Knowles, had a nanuk control issue.
A nanuk control?
Issue.
Issue?
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
An impulse.
Oh.
Nanuk. Impulse. Nanuk.
I wonder what language that is.
I know, it sounds native or something.
It does.
But, I don't know. Anyways, he was struggling with controlling his impulses.
He sure was.
I mean, that's the only part that makes me wonder if he would be like a disorganized killer. But maybe they all struggle with their impulses, except for that. The big guy, Ed Kemper. He had a pretty good control over his impulses.
Israel Keyes, too.
That's true.
He was very controlled.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Back with part three of the Casanova Killer, final part.
Yes.
I have a lame question.
Okay. I want to hear it.
So, I mean, I don't want to like use the wrong language, but what is your stripper name? Meaning, let me just reiterate your name. Okay. Or how about maybe not, that's not the right word. Your Romancing the Stone, Joan Wilder romance author's name. Which would be your middle name and the street you grew up on.
Okay. Well, I have two middle names and...
Okay, then you got a long...
Two different streets that I remember growing up on.
The first one.
The first one.
Yeah.
Okay. So I would be Noelle Brown.
Okay.
Which would be my first middle name and my first street.
Well, that's actually a good...
Noelle Brown.
Yeah. I like that.
If I used my other ones, it would be Colleen Bender, which might be a little different.
Noelle Brown, Colleen Bender.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Noelle Brown's a good.
If you
ever see a book out there by Noelle Brown, could be Courtney.
It's going to be my pseudonym.
Yeah.
My nom de plume, as they say.
Oh, I like that. Is that France? All Francais?
Oui. How about you?
Kathleen Armstrong.
Oh, that's also a good author name.
It's a strong name.
It is.
Armstrong name. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, I can do that on the front of romance novels.
It's totally a romance novel name.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that, you know, back in the 80s, 90s, they would call it your stripper name. That's not allowed anymore. Mm-hmm. Sex worker, whatever. So I'm going to say romance author name.
Yes. There were and are still plenty of things on the internet that's like... Use like your last name and the first letter of the month you were born, and it's this.
Or the last thing you eat.
And your favorite color.
Yeah, so mine would be blue biscuits and gravy.
Oh.
That would be my gnome name.
Oh. Mine would be green gummy worms.
Oh. That's what you had for lunch?
Well, not for lunch.
Okay.
That's a little snack after lunch.
I love gummy bears. I like gummy worms, too. Mm. Sour or regular? Harborough?
Sour.
Sour.
But they were also the freeze-dried ones.
So they that's were like a new thing.
Oh, my gosh. They're so good.
That's a new thing, this freeze-dried shit.
Freeze-dried gummy candies are amazing, and everyone should try them.
I had some, and they're all right. Maybe I need to try a different kind than what I had.
The gummy worms are much more like big and fluffy looking.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Yeah, it's like a new fad I've noticed. I finally tried boba tea.
Oh, yeah, what'd you think?
That's all right.
That's kind of how I feel about it, too.
I like, sometimes I put too many in. Mm. I like a few.
Yeah, too much tapioca.
The ones I get don't have the there are the tapioca balls, but then there's ones with other stuff in it. I'm not sure.
Well, yeah, but they're made of, like, tapioca is like what they're made out of.
I don't know.
I think.
They're clear. Hmm. They're fruit. But
anyway.
Yeah.
We digress.
We do that. So anyways, like I said, part three. And Courtney, recap, please.
Okay. So over the past two episodes, we have learned about Paul's neglected childhood, the abuse he received as a teen, his life of petty crime and car thefts that landed him in and out of jail. And last episode, we talked about Paul falling in love with his prison pen pal, only to be brutally rejected by her when they finally met face to face. This triggered Paul's violent nature and resulted in his first murders. And we left off after Paul had killed his, we're going to go with eighth.
Yeah.
If we're going by the numbers he claimed.
Yeah.
His eighth victim, a hitchhiker, mm-hmm. and found that he rather enjoyed the acts of rape and murder.
So after he killed that hitchhiker, he took greater pains to hide the body. He was trying to be thoughtful about how he now handled things. He hit her well. She was not found for months, and by that time, nature and all of its little beasts had withered her body away until there was nothing left to identify her by, and today she is still classified as a Jane Doe. Paul, now cruising around Georgia, was having a grand old time. That is, until his money started to run out in Missoula. It's not Missoula, Montana. It's Missoula, Georgia. It's spelled differently. On August 23rd, he ran into Kathy Pierce. She was a young mom with a three-year-old son, and he just knocked on her back door in the middle of the day. She answered it. I mean, it seemed like a safe thing to do, and she thought he might be a traveling salesman or something like that. And they chatted for a bit, and then she tried to politely get rid of him. And when she went to shut the door on him, he forced his way inside. She threatened to call the police if he didn't leave. She even got a hold of the phone to do just that, and he was too quick. He grabbed the phone out of her hand and used the phone cord to strangle her. Courtney, do you know that it's possible that some of our listeners may never have seen or used a telephone with a cord?
I know. They don't even know that hang up the phone used to mean actually hanging the phone back on the base on the wall.
I've seen some of those Instagram videos or whatever where, like, they don't know how to use a rotary phone.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I love those. Like, we didn't have one in my house, but my grandma did, and I thought they was so fun.
They're so fun to use play the with.
Rotary. Yeah. It was cool. Sorry, we digress, as we just said we do a lot. He strangled her with the phone cord while her young son stood in the doorway watching. And Paul stared at the child, apparently relishing seeing the child utterly confused about what was happening. He killed this little boy's mother right in front of the little boy. And after she had passed away, Paul waited to see what the boy would do. Well, eventually Paul got bored and started ransacking the house. When he left, the little boy was still in the same spot, staring at his mother's body. Courtney, this is just heartbreaking. What do you think this little boy was understanding? Do you think he remembers what happened? I think of Dexter, who I realize is fictional, but that's what I thought of.
Well, this kiddo, he's 3 years old, so he probably didn't fully understand what was happening. He probably recognized that, you know, his mommy was being hurt by this man, but probably would not have understood death or what that means yet. I imagine that he felt very scared and confused and upset at the time, and being 3 years old, didn't know what to do, you know. But at that age, we as humans do start to retain more long-term memories. So it is possible that he did or does have some memory of his mom's death. And even if he can't remember the exact details or the circumstances about what happened, the emotional consequences of that trauma probably stuck with him.
When her body was discovered, the police would question the little boy over and over, and he could communicate some things about what had happened, but he couldn't describe the man well. All he remembered, I guess, was that the man was smiling at him. Hmm. Courtney, Paul went even a step further. He left the boy alive because he wanted a witness, and he killed his mother in front of him because he wanted to see the little boy suffer. What the fuck?
We are seeing that devolution of Paul's humanity over time. I believe that in the book we used, Paul made a statement of sorts about wanting others to suffer as much as he had suffered in his life. And so, you know, traumatizing this young boy in some twisted way was maybe some, like, vindication or even justice in Paul's mind.
Well, he was again on the road. He crossed into another state and stayed on the DL, the down low. The last kill was enough to keep him going for about 10 days, but then he needed more cash and he wanted to kill. So in September, Paul was in Scott's Inn, a roadside establishment in Lima, Ohio, and decided he wanted to find another wealthy, single lady to seduce as he did Marjorie. He didn't have any luck finding a lady, but he initiated a conversation with William Bates. They talked for hours, and they drank many beers, and by the time they left the bar, it was full dark outside. They were too drunk to drive, but they both got into Paul's, quote, car, stolen car, and headed out. When they left the main thoroughfare, William was too drunk to notice and didn't notice that they got onto an old gravel road. When he eventually did realize they had been driving quite some time on this, you know, out, not the right road, he started to laugh because he assumed that Paul drunkenly took a wrong turn and got them lost. Paul stopped the car, presumably to figure out how to get back on the main road. Then he got out of the car and he opened the passenger door. William got out and sort of staggered and fell backwards. Paul caught him by the neck. Paul just started to laugh and laugh. He was increasing the pressure on William's neck and forcing William to the ground. He was able to get on top of him and use all of his weight. Had William been sober, he could have put up a fight, but as drunk as he was, he just couldn't. Paul killed William, someone who could have been a friend, and he robbed him of his wallet. He went back to the inn, and then he stole his car. Courtney?
By this point, Paul just does not have the ability to form any sort of meaningful connection with others. He can turn on the charm and play the part, which he uses to his advantage, but William would never really have been his friend.
Well, William's body was found a month later in October. Paul had been using William's cash, car, credit cards, and he used them until they were maxed out. He then tossed them like pieces of trash. When he got to Nevada, he pulled into a rest stop where he encountered an elderly couple in a motorhome or a motor coach, whatever. They were Emmett and Lois Johnson, and they were doing what I've always wanted to do. They were touring the United States. So, you know, to digress again, I've always wanted to take several months off to visit some of the states. It would take that long, as the landmass over here is enormous. Every state's different, like pockets of new culture all over, and I wanted to check them out. Don't you, Courtney?
Yes, that would be fun.
Yeah.
Okay. My grandparents did that after they retired. They sold their house and bought a motorhome.
I don't want to wait till I retire, but yes, probably that's when it will happen. But anyways, back to Paul. He went over to the couple and he struck up a conversation and he even helped them put away their chairs. But then he snapped and he grabbed Emmett's throat. Lois started to scream as loud as she could and she tried to beat Paul off her husband, but it didn't work. They fell to the ground and Paul was not going to relent, even with Lois desperately pulling on him, trying to save her husband. She got a new plan and she went into the camper and grabbed a knife. When she turned around, Paul was there, smiling his douchey smile. And he grabbed her jaw with one hand and cruelly snapped her wrist with the other, making her drop the knife. He strangled her, robbed the couple, and then left. Courtney, any thoughts? I mean, he doesn't really seem to have a victim type unless we just think of his victim type as anyone he can rob.
I guess we could say that Paul is an equal opportunity killer. Anyone was fair game if their death served Paul's needs at the time.
Yeah. After this, he headed toward Texas, and around the town of Seguin, he found a female whose car had broken down on the side of the road. This was the perfect opportunity to hunt. He stopped to offer to help, but eventually his evil side came out, and he grabbed her hair and drug her down the embankment out of sight of anyone driving by. He raped and strangled her, just as he had the hitchhiker. Paul realized that he wasn't getting the same high as he had been getting from his killings. He needed more, just like an addict. He did her as best as he could, hit her as best as he could, and destroyed her face with some barbed wire that he found. She, too, could not be identified when she was found. Her face was too severely damaged. Paul was in Birmingham as of September 23rd, and he met Ann Dawson. She was a down-on-her-luck beautician looking for a way out. Paul, for whatever reason, didn't pull his usual scam and kill her, but took her around with him on the road. She had some money and financed the adventure. Paul claims that he could even have regular sex with her and didn't need it to be violent. She was having a great time as they crisscrossed across the Lone Star State. Oh my God. They were going all over Texas. Paul was having a good time too until he wasn't. And eventually he got bored with her. So 6 days after the road trip began, Paul killed Anne and disposed of her body. It still has not been found. Courtney, are you reminded by about Tommy Lynn Sells, not just running around the country, but he too would use people for a while before killing them?
Yes. Tommy Lynn Sells is probably the most similar killer that we've covered to Paul here. And he was also an opportunist who didn't really care much about victimology. Yeah. And he was on the move, committing crimes in various different states, thus making him hard to catch. Yeah. So they had a lot in common.
Yeah. After this, Paul roamed around the U.S. some more for a couple weeks. He was spotted in Oklahoma, Minnesota, Iowa, Missouri, but by mid-October, he was thirsting for another victim. This happened to be in Woodford, Virginia. He forced his way into the home of a 53-year-old woman named Doris Hovey. He apprehended her husband's gun and shot her with it. Of course, the husband was the suspect. Luckily, though, the husband had an alibi. The crime scene was so, quote, clean that they considered that it might be a mafia hit. He didn't rape or rob her. Paul was off again. Courtney, that's a divergence, not even robbing.
It is an odd change in his MO. Not only did he not rob her or sexually assault her, but he also used a gun instead of strangling her. I wonder if he was starting to get bored and just wanted to try something new.
Yeah, I forgot about that, the gun thing. Paul headed back to Florida, and in Key West, he picked up a pair of hitchhikers. The three of them were cruising around in the deceased Williams Bates car from several murders ago when they got onto the back roads. Paul started to speed up, possibly to impress the girls, when he passed a cop car. The police vehicle gave chase, the lights were on and all that. Paul decided to pull over, and if he needed to, he had the two potential hostages in the vehicle for leverage. When Paul spoke to the officer, he acted all embarrassed of what he had done and apologized. The cop figured he was just showing off for his passengers and let Paul go without looking at his ID or running the plates. Well, this was extremely lucky for the girls. Paul was rational in his thinking that if he killed them and they were found, the cop would have put it together and he could have been linked to the crime. So he actually took them to Miami where he said he was going to take them and he let them go. So yeah. Paul next did something interesting that I'm not sure we've seen before. So his brush with the law scared him into realizing that he probably would get caught someday. He found a payphone and called the lawyer who got him out of jail back when Angela had hired him. The lawyer encouraged him to turn himself in. Paul decided to unburden the whole story onto this lawyer. As his story grew more and more disturbing, the lawyer asked Paul to write it down and detail a full confession with as much information as he could provide. The letter was for the lawyer. He would keep it safe, and Paul was protected by client-attorney privilege. Courtney, let's look at this at a therapist, like from a therapist's role. When can you break client-therapist privilege?
So there are very few times that a therapist is allowed to break client confidentiality without consequences. The first is when there's a suspicion of the abuse of a child, elderly person, or a person with a disability. The second is if there's a concern that a client is at imminent risk of taking action to kill themselves. And the last is what is referred to as duty to warn. And so this is when there's a reasonable concern that a client will act on a specific homicidal plan. So an example of this would be if a client shared that they wanted to kill their mother and had a gun in the car and a plan to go to her work this afternoon to shoot her. A vague statement like, "I might kill somebody sometime," does not meet the criteria of duty to warn. And past criminal acts, including murder, unless it is of a protected group like children, are covered by therapist-client confidentiality. And these are, of course, modern laws and standards, as stated in the American Counseling Association Code of Ethics. But they were not the same concern for client privacy back in the 1970s. So I'm not really sure what that would have looked like back then.
So luckily for you working with children, I doubt that you're going to ever have a child that confesses a murder to you. And if so, maybe because they're a child, you can do something. But can you, like, working with an adult, they confess to you murders and you can't do anything about it? I mean, that seems like a lot of burden for, like, someone to know that information.
I mean, it would be a lot. And I think the most ethical thing to do, I think, would be to work with the client to try and get them to turn themselves in. Mm-hmm.
No, it's like a lot of pressure. Well, this didn't sit with me. So I was doing research, on what lawyers client confidentiality shit. And this is per the Florida bar rule 4-1.6 confidentiality of information. So Consent required to reveal information. A lawyer must not reveal information relating to representation of a client except as stated in subdivisions B, C, and D unless the client gives informed consent. So, when lawyer must reveal information. A lawyer must reveal confidential information to the extent the lawyer reasonably believes necessary. One, to prevent a client from committing a crime, or two, to prevent a death or substantial bodily harm to another. So this is a current law. Mm-hmm. I'm not positive what it was in the 70s. It was a struggle to find it in the first place. But this lawyer didn't do that. I suppose he could claim that he didn't think Paul would commit any further crimes, but come on. What are your thoughts, Courtney?
There's a difference between what this lawyer may have believed as a person and what he could do as a professional. It does seem like common sense that if Paul had killed so many people already, he would likely kill again. But because this attorney has no evidence of who or when Paul might act on his urges, there's really not much that he can do. It's kind of similar to like the therapist rule, right? If I don't know what crime he's going to commit and when and where, then I can't prove he's going to do it. And you can't, you know, arrest someone for having thoughts.
Yeah. Essentially. And I mean, I suppose these types of rules are subjective.
Right.
Like in how you interpret them.
Right. That's how I interpreted it.
Yeah.
And it is absolutely frustrating as an outside citizen when this happens, you know, because it can seem so obvious as a solution to just turn somebody in or give information to the police. But without rules like this, you know, the justice system would not be able to work properly the way it does.
Well, I mean, the lawyer didn't turn him in or whatever. And Paul, instead of writing a big long letter, he went to a hotel room and he made tapes. He made audio recorded tapes, and they were long. And the next day, he met up with the lawyer. Well, in some places I read, it said that he mailed it. But the book says that he met up with the lawyer and gave it to him for safekeeping. Well, those tapes, they would eventually be heard by a grand jury, and then investigators would hear them as well. But they would be destroyed in a flood and lost forever after that. So on the tapes, he admitted to many other murders and that we have not gone over. Some of them didn't match up the timeline he offered, and police were skeptical if it could have been him that committed the crimes. But others, such as the double murder in Marlborough, Connecticut, where he raped and murdered a 16-year-old and their mother, was successfully linked to Paul. After he deposited his tapes, he did indeed kill more people. Two of them were a single father and his daughter. Being a good Samaritan, the father, Carswell, offered Paul a place to stay for the night after Paul befriended him and stated he had no place to go. He is also linked to two more hitchhiker deaths around this time as well. Paul met British journalist by the name of Sandy Fox. She was charmed by his good looks and charismatic demeanor, and they hung out for a few days. Paul was unable to consummate their relationship, and I'm assuming by this time he could only do so if the victim was either being raped or if the victim was actually dead. Anyhow, he pitched her a book idea to write about his life, which might be why he let her go when her assignment was finished. However, she met up with him and one of her friends later, and he held her up at gunpoint, the friend, and demanded sex. That friend got away and told the police. So the police did catch up to him, but when they pulled him over, Paul pulled out a sawed-off shotgun and threatened the officer, who had no choice but to let him go. Courtney, anything to add?
So Paul is on record about his desire to be famous, or rather infamous. He wanted people to know his name and his story. And if he couldn't have the love, respect, or attention from, you know, family, friends, or love interests, like most people, then he would try to get it from the public.
Paul broke into a house in West Palm Beach and kidnapped a victim and stole a car. He then dropped off the victim in Fort Pierce. The stolen car was recognized by a patrolman the following night, and he was pulled over. He did the same thing as he had done previously. He was able to grab the officer's gun and take him hostage. He's bold. Not only did he take the officer hostage, but he also took the police car. At some point, he flipped on the lights and pulled over another car. And basically, at this point, he carjacked that car. And now he has both the police officer and the car's owner as hostages. He drove them out to a secluded area in Pulaski County, now in Georgia, handcuffed both men to a tree, and shot them both dead. By this time, the police were looking for him all over. The abandoned police car had been found, and they were able to hone in on the area he might be in. So they set up roadblocks. Paul, now fueled by adrenaline and narcissistic immunity and God knows whatever else, attempted to plow through the roadblock, which he did, but then he crashed into a tree. It wasn't over, though. Paul started to run. He was pursued by dogs and helicopters, and he was finally found and caught by a civilian with a weapon on November 17th. Woohoo, Richard Ramirez style.
That's right.
So, yes, he's finally caught. While in custody, he claimed that he killed 35 people. Not all of those could be verified, as we've been saying. And the next day, he was being transferred to a maximum security facility, and Paul pulled a Paul. He picked the lock on his handcuffs and attempted to confiscate the sheriff's firearm, but the accompanying FBI agent, Ron Angel, had his own weapon ready and shot Paul before he could do anything else. Paul died right there in the vehicle. Courtney, what do you think about this desperate act? Do you think he wanted suicide to die by cop? Do you think he wanted suicide by cop, or do you think he thought he might actually get away with this?
I think that Paul, once again, found himself with nothing to lose and the promise of a long prison sentence or the death penalty in his future. Mm-hmm. So I think this was a Hail Mary attempt where he was either going to get away one last time and disappear, or he was going to die trying. And, you know, just imagine the potential publicity and fame he could get if he successfully escaped from custody during transport to prison.
Right.
Now, especially that he was known to be a serial killer. Unfortunately for Paul, that's not what happened, and he was relegated to relative obscurity.
Why do you think that is? Because the story is pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
what I think happened was, like I think we've said before, he was operating around the same time as like Ted Bundy and mm-hmm. and that type. But then Ted Bundy got caught, and then Ted Bundy liked to talk.
Yeah.
And he talked to everyone who would listen.
Yeah.
And so I think that that is sort of why he ended up being so famous,
mm-hmm.
where Paul died before mm-hmm. he even had a trial.
So, you know, possibly if he had all of the things, we would know a lot more about him
mm-hmm.
if the tapes hadn't been destroyed. Also, right. Had those been released.
Yeah, if you can imagine if he'd gone to that prison
mm-hmm.
and stayed there and had a trial and had his murder tape confessions mm-hmm. played in court and had yeah. the opportunity to do interviews.
Although like, the tape probably wouldn't be admissible, blah, blah, blah. But
well, yeah,
still. Anyway. But yeah, I mean, mm-hmm. he probably would have been a talker too.
Right.
Yeah, I didn't read anything about him getting any sort of psychiatric testing any of the times he was in prison. Like,
nope. Well, he was just in there, like,
for burglaries and stuff like that.
Yeah, he was just, like, a car thief and a petty theft. And
so, I mean, in a way, like, there is a lot we don't know about him.
Right.
Because there wasn't a lot of deep dives into his mental health or, you know, whatever. And like I said, this book is, a lot of it is from his words or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Yeah.
Well, anyway, that's how his story ended. He was pretty young when he died.
I don't think he was even 30 yet.
Yeah.
Or had maybe just turned 30, maybe. It would have been one hell of a life story.
Yeah.
Like, if he'd gotten to write an autobiography.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, that's that.
Yeah. Kind of a, I don't know. Such a non-dramatic ending for such a dramatic
Well, I bet life. The FBI agent didn't feel that way.
Well, that's true.
But, yeah. Sometimes I feel like when we present these stories, by the time we get to the ending, we're just sort of, like, over it.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we don't pack as big of a punch as we should. I should have been like, and then he was killed by the FBI agent in the car, blood everywhere.
Yeah, but also don't want to glorify
that's true.
These guys.
No,
so.
They're not good people at all.
No.
Oh, and Courtney, we didn't point this out, but we had our 100th episode recently.
We did.
And what I wanted for our 100th episode was to do Jeffrey Dahmer. That was my goal. I think I said that even in one of our earlier ones.
I think you did.
And I'm just going to give it away. We are doing Jeffrey Dahmer next.
Yes. We miscalculated a little bit.
I miscalculated. I was like, shit, if I switch out Paul John Knowles and Jeffrey Dahmer, I could do it on the 100th. But because technically, not BTK, what the hell, the Toy Box Killer, the second one was the 100th. But our first episode is just us saying, hey, listen to Addicted to Murder. So I don't count that.
Right.
So really, no. PJK part one was our 100th. You guys don't care. But I couldn't believe we were at 100 episodes.
I know.
That's a lot.
That's wild to think about.
Thank you guys for hanging in with us for this long.
Right.
I mean, yeah. So anyways, I gave it away. Jeffrey Dahmer is next. Whenever we do that, we might have something special in between now and then that we're going to release.
Yeah. Too. So keep your eyes and ears open.
Yeah. But Courtney, until then, what do we do when a good looking bad boy type offers us a beer at a local upscale establishment?
We go nuts, go home, and go to therapy.
Yes, yes, yes. Everyone be safe, and we will see you next Tuesday.
Bye. Bye.